You're listening to Event CEO, a podcast for executives who are looking to maximize their event ROI through business strategy, technology, and innovation.
Hello and welcome to the Event CEO podcast. Thank you for listening and sharing part of your day with us. I'm your host, Rebecca Linder, founder and CEO of Linder Global Events. And today, we're so pleased to have on the show Mo Ejlali, president of Mindful Leader, Inc., producers of the Mindful Life and the Mindful Leadership Summit. Welcome, Mo.
Thank you, Rebecca.
So nice to have you. So why don't we start with, what is the Mindful Leadership Summit? I have attended, of course, but I would love to hear from you.
Yeah. And so the Mindful Leadership Summit, we're in our fifth year now. The idea around it really is to bring together people who are looking at how to incorporate mindfulness into the workplace and incorporate mindfulness into becoming a better leader.
And then what drives you to do this work?
Tell
your story.
I think the easiest way to put it was I was a very unmindful leader running a very unmindful organization. With the turn of the economy, the organization got flipped upside down. And when I had to take a hard look at myself and what I was doing and what I became, I didn't really like what I saw. And that forced me to ask myself deeper questions. Why am I here? What's this all for? And in that journey, I discovered meditation and mindfulness and realized that there's organizations out there that are successful, that are profitable and growing rapidly. The Googles of the world, the LinkedIn, General Mills, that have found ways to grow and be successful and incorporate mindfulness and compassion. And when I discovered that, I had this urge to help share that with others that might be heading down the same path that I was.
So it's 5 years old, you said, the organization as well as the summit itself?
Yeah, the organization. So I started blogging and doing workshops around mindfulness in 2010. The organization didn't officially launch until 2013.
And what were your goals when you first started and how have they evolved?
So when we first started, it was a side project. I was full-time, I think for NASA at that time, doing government contracting. And the goal was just to see if we could do it. Like, we didn't even think we put together an event and invited a couple of folks and just to see if there was enough energy and excitement around just the concept. And frankly, like, I didn't really expect much. And just given where things were at and in terms of just the general mood out there. And we were really blown away by how many people were willing to participate, were willing to help us get the word out, and that wanted to see this to manifest, to see it come into reality.
Something that I think would be interesting to our audience is, you know, this is a new event and a new organization. And quite frankly, not a controversial topic, but a new topic for the corporate scene. How did you gain traction around the event? How did you draw in an audience? Who did you reach out to?
When I think back, there was a couple things. So probably the 4 years before we launched the event, like, I'd done a good deal of work and just learning and did a year-long certification program around coaching, read a ton of books and all the stuff that was out there, just took it all in and digested that. I started to go to events and events around mindfulness and just business and looking for speakers and looking for people that we might want to engage. And at the same time, I'm really involved in the local Washington, D.C. area meditation community, specifically an organization called Insight Meditation Community of Washington that was started by Tara Brach, which is a really well-known meditation teacher, and got involved with that, got more and more involved and ended up on the board. And so having Tara's endorsement and having her really champion us helped open a lot of doors. And then a lot of it was just hustle. I'd go to these other events and I'd approach everyone and anyone who was willing to talk to us and hear what we're up to, I'd reach out to. And so...
And are you paying for, I mean, again, as a new event, are you paying for most of your speakers to come, or are they doing it as a way to gain visibility? What's that conversation you're having with them to get them there?
Yeah, so for the most part, it's to gain visibility. We'll do things like transportation, hotel reimbursement. We've done small honorariums, but most of the speakers, and these are like people that I would have never imagined that we'd get, like Mark Tursak, the CEO of Nature Conservancy. Mm-hmm. We had Congressman Tim Ryan. I mentioned Tara Brach, Sharon Salzberg. And these are folks who, if they wanted to, really could command quite a lot to show up at an event. But with us, there was a sense, I think, of both wanting to see this happen and really just caring about this work. And because we had relationships with folks that they knew, this trust in us and willingness to jump in.
So it sounds like the jump in is the part of the advice is just to get out there and, you know, leverage your networks, because it is a big challenge for new events in particular to get off the ground that are cause-based. It's still hard to draw in not only the audience, but also the speakers that will draw the audience that they want without going broke.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, relying on your network clearly is important.
Relying on your network. And then I think having this understanding that you might have to ask 20 people to get 5 to say yes. And so when you go in with that mentality, it just makes it easier to deal with situations where people might say no, and just understanding that you have to make a certain number of contacts and keep going.
The law of averages. So for you, what were some of the biggest challenges in starting an event from the ground up?
Wow. So when we started, my partner had done some events. I came in with very little of a background in events, and there was a lot of learning and a lot of, and I'm smiling because I'm just remembering the first one we did, like we did everything. I mean, we went to Costco and like bought like the tea and bought like the water jugs, and I pulled in my family and everyone was carrying all this stuff into our cars. I mean, we really bootstrapped it, and being involved in just like every aspect makes me appreciate the work that you guys do so much more, and an understanding of how many things could go wrong, like so many things could go wrong. And so it was really just going in and rolling our sleeves back and jumping into it and kind of doing everything ourselves and learning as we go. And just my approach in general is just continuous improvement and just being willing to take a hard look at what worked, what didn't, and just continuing to nudge forward. So.
And in that vein, how are you determining to use it, you know, the tried and true ROI? I mean, what is it both on the sort of tangibles and intangibles for you that you sort of say, okay, this was successful versus this is what we need to continue to strive for?
It's a great question. So there's three things that come to my mind. It's always important to me that whatever we do really embodies who we are. And so that's an element of it. Like, does sort of the vibe speak for itself? And does that come across? And the interactions people have, the experience people have. There's also the profitability and sustainability. Like, there's certain numbers that we need to reach with the hotels. And again, like, this is all relatively new to me within the last 5 years. But there's like really significant liabilities with the hotels that we work with.
Right.
And so taking that into consideration, making sure that both our business strategy and our targets line up in a way that the event won't put us at risk. And then for us, as we're growing to our next phase, like the events provide a contact with people that we wouldn't otherwise have. Like a lot of our direct connection, a lot of our products that we're launching now, we're timing with the events. And so the events provide that means to really engage folks. And that way, when they return to whatever country or state they're from, we could continue to build that relationship.
And are you drawing in people from all over the world?
We are. Yeah. We had people from over 34 countries attend.
This year's.
In the last 2 years, I would have to look a little bit more closely.
Wow.
But so.
And how many people attended this last year?
This last year, we had 750 people.
Okay. And your first year, how many did you have?
We had 350.
350. Wow, big. So double. That's great. And now, how are you drawing in the audience? So how are you finding them? What's that effort look like?
One of the early things that I realized was that with the events, and especially because people invest quite a lot, they buy the ticket, they have to do the hotel, air, all that stuff. And so it's not so transactional. And we learned a bit. Early on, we were fortunate because we had great partnerships and alliances. And so we've got organizations who have an established brand, established credibility, have a relationship of trust with their audience. And when they get behind us and they endorse what we're doing, it really makes a huge difference. And that's been critical in every year. What we've started to look at and an area that we're continuing to develop is to move away from this idea of like a transactional relationship, to leverage the assets that we have. We have a ton of video. We have access to these incredible speakers and folks, and to provide free resources and ways for people to engage, to learn more about mindful leadership, to maybe go a little bit deeper with a certain speaker, and to have a conversation and cultivate the relationship, and then really moving to rely more on our email and some of the retargeting ads that we do to promote whatever offer and product that we have.
thinking about an audience that, you know, in our audience that's either trying to come up with an event, whether it's an established organization or not, how do they learn how to do that from a marketing or a digital marketing perspective? Is that something you knew? Is there certifications you sought, or is there research that you did that would be helpful to sort of illuminate for the audience here? Or do you just know that because you're that guy?
It's so funny. So I'll share with you, this is what I don't talk about often. When I was at Virginia Tech undergrad, I was doing computer engineering, and on the side, there was a shortage of really good music Friday and Saturday nights. And so I actually, when I reflect back, like my first event, I promoted DC Flavor Dance Ecstasy at Virginia Tech Friday and Saturday nights. And so that was like my first event, my first sort of marketing of events. And my background, I've done a whole lot around technology and marketing, and all that became very helpful with the events. And I think the key thing is to be able to just step into the shoes of a person who might attend an event and really take the time to think about, I thought about my own experiences and what events do I go to and what was the process for me to come to that decision. Okay. And so that helped.
And then when you're doing retargeting, you're talking about Facebook ads and, you know.
Yeah, Facebook. And to get really specific, we use Facebook, we use Google retargeting. I do what I would consider campaign blitzes, where short periods of time will really emphasize and I'm trying to find a gentler word, but really we bombard people.
Bombard's okay.
We bombard them. And there's certain spurts that we do that. And then there's sort of longer tail type marketing that we do as well.
Interesting. And then email, though, is a big part of how you're reaching out to people as well.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And more we're shifting towards a lot of our marketing to pull people in to sign up for the email list. And then a lot of the marketing itself through the email. We run a best of video series, which is free video from previous conferences that we offer to people who subscribe to the email. We offer different discounts and specials to people who are subscribed to the email. And we're exploring other ways to just continue to engage folks.
That's great. And then in terms of some of the content that you're repurposing, do you have someone who's doing that on your staff, or are you editing that yourselves, or are you guys putting that outside in terms of the asset collection side?
Yeah. So a lot of it's internal. We do have a wonderful videographer and editor that's been coming to the events from the beginning. And so he really has a passion for this work as well. And he's been doing all the editing and capturing the video. This year, we increased our budget and added a second cameraman to help capture some of the content from another room. And I'm continuing to explore what ways can we expand that. And this is the first year that we charge attendees for video. And we're offering video of the event to our broader audience as well to help cover the costs and look at how we can continue to grow that.
And were you streaming the event live so people could watch it virtually, or no?
No.
Did you want to sell that as?
Yeah. And just mixed feelings about streaming. And we haven't figured out how that would fit into our strategy just yet. And I just put it that way. I think there's more technical challenges. And to stream right, there's a bit of an investment necessary. We did it 1 year where we streamed one of the sessions and the results were relatively good, but it's just something we haven't come back to yet.
So a question for you. So given that often a value proposition to a sponsor is, you know, the audience who will be there. Yet in the beginning of this conversation, you had mentioned that actually, the sponsors have come on board and have been a big help to you in terms of getting that actual audience there. So two questions. One, are what is that question that you're asking that the sponsors, are they giving you their list or are they actually just exposing their list to you guys? That's the first question. The second one is, what are they looking for from your event in particular? Like, how are you satisfying them and elevating your game to meet their criteria?
Those are great questions. The first thought that comes to my mind is that because what we're doing is so different and new, that it's always tricky to find who are the right organizations who would sponsor, because it doesn't exist already. So there isn't anything to kind of look at and feel out. And for us, and our sponsors have been fantastic, and there was the element of them helping get exposure, in that we don't ask for email addresses just to respect people's privacy, and most of them wouldn't offer that. We do look at how we could fit into how they operate. So some of them have newsletters, some of them will do dedicated emails, We've had other opportunities like being incorporated to their events and the content that they put out there. And our sponsors have included everything from magazines to universities to corporations to nonprofits. So just this really wide mix of folks. And we'll look at where they fit best. And so we've got different tiers of sponsorship and just not trying to push or force something onto an organization that doesn't match. And then also looking at the relationship beyond just monetary. So looking at both in terms of if they don't have the funds or the budget, is there something else that they might have in terms of that exposure and promotion that we could play with? And then looking at them in terms of, do they embody our mission and our way of doing things? Like, is there a fit beyond just that transaction?
Well, one of the things, so I've had the great fortune of going and attending for 2 years in a row. And what was really surprising to me, and maybe it's because I'm like a closet meditator, was how many corporations there and how many actual corporate people were there. And I thought I was going to come to, you know, patchouli or whatever, you know, some incense. And I had this very different expectation as I was exploring, you know, mindful leadership for myself and for my company. But I was quite shocked at, you know, you had Starbucks there, you had Google, you know, this year, GlaxoSmithKline. I mean, major, major companies, Enpro, which was a terrific conversation. Talk, just because of my own personal interest, talk a little bit about the appetite around this subject and what it means for us as a corporate community going forward, and what you think that sort of more universal consciousness is all about and how it's evolving. Because it speaks directly to the sponsors and how you'll grow potentially as well.
What comes up for me is that I think when we look at it, and we've all experienced this directly, something's broken. There was a study that was put out in Fortune magazine a couple weeks ago where it was 65% of employees would rather replace their boss than get a raise.
You saw that. That's incredible.
Yeah. And when you look at that, and when you look at how much, I feel like there's just so much pressure on us, especially just the current climate, but there's so much pressure on us from all the different aspects of work and family life. And stress and insomnia and all sorts of issues that if we don't make a change, it's not sustainable. And sometimes that's what it takes for people and organizations and societies to wake up. Like when things hit that point that they just don't look like they're sustainable. When I look at some of the things that really excite me and why I think that this is catching on, I think when you look at the younger generation, they're just not going to put up with the way that their grandparents were treated at work and sort of punching in, punching out and treated like objects. Like they're just not going to put up with that. When you look at women in the workplace and all the changes that are coming out, they're not going to subscribe to the old masculine alpha male.
Certainly not right now.
Especially not right now. Yeah, that's going to become, before that was like a thing people would look for. And now I think there's going to be the shift to like, away from that. Like you're not going to want to associate, you're not going to want to work with someone like that. Whereas when I started my first company, that was what was encouraged, that you've got to be strong, you've got to be aggressive and this alpha male. And then I think the potential damage that we're doing to the environment and the planet, like we've got to take a hard look at why are we really here and not get caught up in the mechanism and kind of return to the reality.
What is the time frame around all of this in terms of, I feel like it's quickening the pace. I mean, even going from last year to this year in terms of attending the event, I mean, you know, you had DC Public Schools there and they've tried to infuse meditation and mindfulness practices into the school system. It feels very palpable.
It's exciting, but there's also this maturity that's happening within the industry and within the movement where in certain cases, there was a bit of overhype. And as excited as everyone's been, sometimes too much excitement isn't a good thing. And so early on, there was this great excitement and in certain cases, a lot of controversy about overpromising things and over what they call, I think it's like a scientific research bias, where a lot of the science that was being put out there was only looking at the positive effects. And some of the articles that I'm starting to see now and that are coming out more and more are providing a bit of grounding to the movement. And then also, I think helping specify what actually works and what doesn't. This idea of mindfulness and meditation is so broad and could include so many different things that in this maturity, there's this real focus on what actually works and what doesn't. That sense of the entire industry maturing is happening throughout, and we're seeing changes within organizations that have been in the space for a while, and seeing just the adaptation with more and more schools, more and more universities, more and more companies. There's definitely this demand out there, but some key things are missing. There aren't standards for certification. There isn't an industry nonprofit or association. And in other countries, specifically like Australia and the UK, they seem to be a little bit ahead of us.
Interesting. Do you see sort of the work that you're doing now potentially culminating in creating that association or creating some of that certification?
So
being a part of that?
Being a part of it, yes. And there have been a couple initiatives and a couple of organizations that I've been directly involved in and in trying to help. It's too early to say what's going to come together. So yeah, there's a couple of organizations that are out there that seem to be moving in that direction and we're supporting, but still sort of waiting to see if they're going to get their foot in.
Is there a fair amount of, in terms of back to the event and the summit that you're hosting, is there a lot of competition in this space for you, or are you kind of out front?
I would say when I look at the landscape, there's a really fantastic event called Wisdom 2.0.
Which is a great event. Yeah.
Really great event. And what they do, and Soren, the guy who started it, really incredible guy. And a lot of the speakers and folks I mentioned earlier in the events, that was one of the events I went to. And with them, I'd highly recommend it. It's a bit of a broader umbrella where they're really looking at mindfulness, and they're looking at mindfulness and technology. Okay. And it kind of has this wonderful, almost like a Burning Man feel where there's a lot of art and creativity and exploration. And so I would highly recommend checking out Wisdom 2.0. There's a couple events that are more geared towards the corporate audience. So I attended the Conference Board. Now it's putting on events around resilience and mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And these are really geared towards Fortune 500 companies, looking at, you know, chief learning officers and head of HR. And so their website has a couple. So the resiliency and mindfulness events are the two that I'm aware of. And there's a couple other, and I can't remember the name of the specific one that's coming to mind, but there's some really cool events out there that are looking at the changing of the HR landscape. And not just like mindfulness, but sort of
in a
general way.
And how do you distinguish yourself from those other events? Or do you feel like there's enough room even to overlap?
I like to distinguish ourselves and just from business strategy perspective, and just what excites me is to be number one in a space,
okay.
Even if it's a small space.
I like it.
I feel like for us, this combination of really sticking to mindfulness and looking at leadership and workplace, like that mix, it doesn't seem like anyone's really focused on that. There's different flavors of that out there. And ultimately, I feel that there's that balance of sort of having some flavor and having some spice, some kick mm-hmm. to what we're doing and not being too broad. And I feel like the mindfulness and the different speakers and organizations that we've really aligned with create a really unique experience.
And it sounds like you use that as a kind of a filter and a lens for yourself. If you start to veer off, you're kind of refocus on, okay, does it satisfy all the criteria that we've said is our spicy place?
Yeah. Our spicy place. And on top of it, does it taste good to me? Ultimately.
There you go. As the head of the whole thing, that's important. So you attend many events and you mentioned that. What makes a great event in your opinion? What aspects of that are you seeing at your own?
What makes a great event is when you leave it, it's almost like, I love music. I absolutely love music. And I'm just relating to like the greatest events I've been to pretty much are music, like concerts, like intimate live concerts where you go and when you leave, you feel something incredibly deep, like your whole mind, your body, like everything comes out feeling like you just experienced something that was incredible. And that experience was so incredible that it lingers. And you want to pull other people into it and you want to have more of it. I'm intentionally avoiding the term, you know, saying like it was a spiritual experience, but just because I don't want to confuse people with Mindful Leadership Summit, but it is kind of a spiritual experience. There's something deep that really
you embody the whole kind of every aspect of you is moved.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. That's how I felt at yours. Mm-hmm. So how have you changed as a leader over time? Throughout this process, you had mentioned before in your previous life, which is, you know, you were more hard charging, but how have you evolved within the space now?
So here's the funny thing. So in my previous life, I was too profit and sort of bottom line driven and hard driving. And then as things happened, then as I shifted into this mindful leadership and a more compassionate workplace, I almost went a little bit too far to the left. And I'm just using left because mm-hmm. that's the way my hands are pointed. And now it's been finding that balance. Like, it's one thing to be profitable and successful, and it's another thing to be mindful and compassionate. But when you've got to hit numbers and when you've got to have difficult conversations with folks or part ways, and doing that with mindfulness and compassion, like, that's an edge that is incredibly hard and that I'm not going to pretend to have mastered, but that I'm continuing to develop and just having that and, like, being sustainable, profit-driven, and being mindful and compassionate.
It's a very fine line to thread. And we deal with a lot of our audience are nonprofits that really, I think, often that nagging, my God, am I too profitable? Or, you know, but yet how do I serve as a result? What are you doing actively to improve your own leadership?
A lot of our partners and the wonderful speakers and folks that we have coming to the summit are also people whose programs and who I've engaged with closely. And I just have a big smile on my face because I feel incredibly fortunate to have access to these folks outside of just taking in all the stuff that we're doing and all the resources that I have access to. We're launching a book club. And
fantastic.
The book club starts in January, and I'm hosting the book club. And so part of that will be, not only will I be hosting, but I'll be reading and engaging the authors around these topics. And for me, like, that's the ultimate way to get me to kind of take that next step, is to play a role in sharing. So
that's so fantastic. And will that be a virtual platform, or how will you be doing that?
Virtual platform. And so we're sending people the books.
Okay.
And then we've got author webinars over Zoom. So there's a video conferencing one a month in January, February, March. And then we have a forum where people who are reading the books could share and trade notes and engage each other.
And so is it a membership base? I'd love to just quickly touch on the model.
Yeah, it's a 3-month program and people sign up each quarter. And right now we're testing it. It's pilot. We're doing Foundations of Mindful Leadership. And if the results look like I'm hoping they will, then we're going to add more different flavors and in different book clubs and looking at how to keep people continuously engaged.
Oh, fantastic. Another way of keeping them kind of year round versus just the, you know, the one event a year.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Any advice you'd give to leaders today in our current world?
So when you said that, the first thing that came up for me was our political leaders, and I've got like a whole set of
be
advice
kind.
For them.
That's what I always say. Just be nice.
Be nice. And I think for leaders, and I know this has all been said before, but to realize that if they haven't caught on to this, but that there's a lot of innovation happening around culture and around leadership itself. Often we look for innovation around technology, or, you know, can I improve this process and take care of these financial things? But there isn't that focus on leadership and culture. And I feel like in the past that leaders could get away with that and companies could get away with that. We're reaching a point now, if people don't take a hard look and see, just the same way that you do with everything else, look at the trends, look at the numbers, look at what's happening, and really tune into that, add that to the focus, that their organizations could be in trouble.
You heard that from this man right here, Mo. He says, pay attention to what's happening in the cultural sort of innovation space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mo, it's been wonderful.
Can I add one more
yes,
thing?
Yes, please, please, please.
Because I did this recently and I'm really excited to share it. Another thing I'd really encourage leaders to do, on my to-do list, I will add a line to relax and like.
It's a good one. So, I have a reminder on my phone. Probably, I think it's every hour it comes up and says, let it go, relax, and take a walk.
Beautiful.
So whether I do all those three things every time it comes up, but it does remind me of the mental space I'm in and the physical space I'm in at that moment. So it's good advice. Mo, as always, it's a pleasure seeing you and thank you for being here today. We really appreciate you being our guest on our show today and providing your incredible insights. In our next episode, we'll be doing a short, quick fire question round with Mo. Thanks for listening. Until next time, make your days great.